Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel. And today I'm speaking with Ulla Berg, author of Mobile Selves, Race, Migration, and Belonging in Peru and the U.S., published by the New York University Press in 2015. Dr. Berg is trained as an anthropologist and holds the position of associate professor in the departments of Latino and Hispanic Caribbean Studies and Anthropology at Rutgers University. Her research and teaching interests include migration, mobility, transnationalism, globalization, media, ritual and performance, and visual anthropology. In particular, her research explores the historical and contemporary processes of and experiences of migration and mobility within Latin America and between Peru and the United States. Hello, Ulla, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you so very much, TT.
Great. I was hoping you could begin our conversation today by telling us a little bit about your personal and professional background.
Absolutely. So, as you already mentioned, I'm a sociocultural but also a visual anthropologist by training, and I specialize in both in Latin America and in Latino communities in the United States. And I think for a Latino studies scholar, I probably have a little bit of an unorthodox background because I grew up in Denmark, where I also did my undergraduate and MA work at the University of Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. And I came to the U.S. in 2001, which was just a month after 9/11, to do graduate studies in anthropology at NYU. And I think this sort of whole moment of my arrival in the U.S., of course, affected my entire outlook on U.S. society, but it also affected the processes of migration that I was studying and the kind of subsequent policies governing the movement of people in and out of the country, right? And it was also it also shaped, I think, my view on Latin American migration, that even though that I was born and raised for the first 19 years of my life in Europe, I spent a significant amount of time in Latin America. Mm-hmm. Before I even came to the U.S., I didn't come to the U.S. I came to the U.S. for the first time I was in my mid-20s. And before that, I had spent numerous years in Latin America, so I kind of came late to the U.S., as it were. Mm-hmm. And I should say that is, I'm mentioning this, and that is significant because in a way that also means that I came to Latino studies somewhat accidentally, I would say, by virtue of following my interlocutors across borders from Latin America to the U.S. because I was already working as an anthropologist and I had studied at Latin American universities. And then, you know, I came to do field work in the United States more or less at the same time as the subjects that I was studying when I came to graduate school. So I think that also reflects sort of my more hemispheric view, as it were, of Latino studies as encompassing, you know, of course, the U.S., but definitely to a great extent, the home regions that people are migrating from in Latin America.
Certainly, no, definitely. And I think that that's very fascinating to hear, you know, both of how you came to the subject matter, but also how that helped you to see and maybe start to envision this project, you know, hemispherically, which your project certainly does. I mean, taking both a transnational look at the experiences of Andean Peruvian migrants, but also it's situated in multiple local sites. Can you tell us a bit more about how the project itself developed?
How it came about?
Yes.
Yes. Well, you know, for a long time, I was interested in the topic of human migration, and probably also perhaps part of my own biography. But I think, you know, human migration, it is one of the most important issues of our time, and it shapes the lives of millions of people, and it also affects the future of many more. And I think I decided to write this book, of course, because it was the right way of disseminating the work that I had been doing in Peru and also with Andean communities in the U.S. But also, I guess, out of a sense of urgency about the topic. The book originally started as a dissertation, but has then morphed into sort of a very different beast. And I think one of the things that I was pursuing was that I was slightly dissatisfied with the way that Latin American migrations have been conceptualized, both in my own discipline of anthropology, but also in the U.S. immigration literature, because migration is not just about getting from point A to point B, obviously, but it's the embodied experience that occurs in a larger economy of signification, and also that experience has to be validated by all of these larger institutions and structures of power. And I think in many of the studies in the U.S. immigration literature, it kind of placed the United States squarely at the center and sort of the site that came to create value for people's experiences, right? I thought of the only context that gave meaning to the migration journey and the process. And that to me was simply inaccurate. And I saw that in my work because people don't migrate out of nowhere, but they're part of these very dense histories and fabrics of social relations already in their home countries, right, that inform their experiences in very significant ways a long time before they even arrive to the U.S., right? So that was, I think, one of my sort of initial motivations. And, of course, also because prior to working on transnational migration and doing fieldwork in the U.S., I was working in Peru, and I was looking at first the study of rural to urban migration, and then also at the impact of transnational migration in home communities in the Andes. And what I saw was that transnational migration, of course, had a very significant impact on local communities and local economy, but it was also almost as if it were sort of like the last stage of a century-long history of mobility, right? That it was sort of a last phase, as it were. So it wasn't perhaps that it sort of radically transformed these communities, but that it kind of added on to the scale almost, and that it allowed for an expansion of Andean livelihoods. Now, previously, people had migrated from Andean communities to sort of highland cities or maybe to the capital of Lima, but now they were kind of extending that livelihood, right, that mobile livelihood beyond the borders of Peru. So I also think that that informed my approach, that I approach migration as an embodied experience, but also as a sort of a spatial extension of a form of livelihood that Andean populations have been engaged in for centuries, right?
Great points. Yes, and I appreciate that as a historian of the United States, as I typically, you know, as I teach classes and interact with students, one of the things that I'm most grateful for that migration scholars have brought into, I think, the study of American history is the transnational perspective that migrants have and that scholars like yourself have had to adopt and developed in really trying to understand the social experiences of these people have really helped to destabilize the concept of the nation. You talk about being dissatisfied initially with how migration itself was discussed in the literature, particularly in the United States, and that's right because of the nationalist frame of that shaped a lot of these studies, right? That viewed, the U.S., of course, as a land of opportunity and thereby, you know, pulling these migrants because of its, concepts such as freedom and, opportunity for social mobility and, you know, bootstrap mentality, all that stuff, right? This was the land where that could thrive and flourish and thereby that. That's how, you know, migration was understood for so long. And of course, in, you know, probably through the process of the mid to late 20th century, more probably the latter 20th century, migration scholars really started to contest those notions, you know, looking, that is, migration from the U.S. outward. And now we're looking at it, as you've mentioned, from, what have come to be called sending regions, right? From that perspective and the process of mobility as a historical process, as you mentioned, beginning from rural to urban migrations, whether, we're talking about the 20th, 21st century, even centuries ago, you know, migration scholars have begun to identify that transnational migration, right, is now kind of like one of the culminating or latter extensions of this process of mobility and migration that is very deeply rooted in the human condition and, you know, as a strategy, right, to survive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that has been very productive for me in my own research, and also it allowed me to connect sort of a trajectory in Andean studies and in studies of mobility in the Andes with sort of more broader transnational migration literature. And I should also say another important point that I'm trying to do in the book is because I'm in dialogue with the transnational migration literature, also trying to figure out how we could sort of go beyond exactly that framework of the transnational or the national in the transnational, because I think even the transnational migration framework was also sometimes too much focused on the national in the transnational and then ended up somehow reiterating these national origin groups that scholars simultaneously critiqued in the U.S. immigration literature, right? And I think one of the things that I'm trying to show in the book is that how we can't take membership of national origin groups for granted in the first place, right?
Exactly, right.
And so in the case of Peru, and this is what I'm showing in my book, is that many of these migrants of rural and Andean origin who sort of get catapulted into these transnational migration circuits, they were never really full citizens in their own country. Right?
Exactly.
So when they migrate abroad and they migrate to the U.S., one of the sort of main predicaments for many of them is exactly to become members of Peru and of the Peruvian citizenry, right? Even though that they are abroad. So it's actually not about the American dream. it's about becoming someone in the context of these larger historical processes of membership that encompass both the country and the region of origin, right? As well as the United States.
Yes, and this is what interests me the most about your book, and I think the title does a great job of really setting that off initially is, you know, how the concepts of self and identity and subjectivity are all intertwined right within the process of movement and mobility, whether that's within, a nation and across regions, as we're talking about initially here with Andean migrants, or even transnationally, that throughout these processes of movement, people are continually was it rethinking and reimagining themselves and producing themselves in new ways to create to obtain a desirable result, right?
Yes.
And so your book breaks this up in three different parts. There's the first part entitled Cosmopolitan Desires is more about the initial process of, you know, leaving a sending region or, you know, leaving, you know, an Andean community. First, the, you know, how the migrant imagines that and then how it is experienced. And in the first chapter, so you produce these two examples of Ines and Domitila, right, are two of the women that you study. Can you talk a bit about their experiences and how they exemplify what you start to find, what you're discussing in the book about both how they imagine this experience of migration, what's driving that, and then how their own experiences themselves work to start to, you know, shape their concept of self and their identity, how that's evolving throughout this process?
Yes, absolutely, and thank you for that question. So I think I took the cases of these two women. I had many fascinating cases and testimonies that I could choose from, but I think somehow they came to stand out as emblematic for this desire for migration that many people in the Central Andes and in countryside across Latin America and also in Northern American areas, of course, they have, or that desire for mobility that they have. So, for example, in the case of Ines, Ines is a woman and a friend that I've known for many, many years since my first field work in Peru, and I stayed with her family, and I also witnessed sort of her family and the family history being transformed by migration over several generations. And one of the things that always fascinated me with her and her story was that they had their family home sort of next to this highway that runs through the central highlands from the mining economies of Huancavelica and Ayacucho and then down to the coast of Lima. So it was really sort of this road that connected this area of the highlands with Lima on the coast and with the sort of accompanying notion of a capital and of progress and of getting ahead in life, etc. So a lot of her life evolved around the sort of economy of the roadside, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it came out in many conversations with her over the course of the years that I followed her, you know, how strong that desire for mobility was. And Ines, she was someone who had the possibility for family reunification. Her father had left in the late 1970s to the U.S., and he was trying for years to go to the United States through family reunification, but that didn't quite work out. So she also simultaneously applied for a visa and, you know, working all these multiple strategies that many aspiring migrants do. And over the course of a number of years, each time I returned to Peru, you know, I saw her and we would talk about migration and talk about her plans. And then suddenly, one day, she was gone. Or it was not all that suddenly, because it had been sort of on the way for a very long time. So she ended up in Miami, living with an uncle and with her sister, who also had managed to travel. But her arrival in the United States was sort of heartbreaking in many ways, because her story, you know, and the early interviews that I had with her had sort of this character of almost an overflow of aspiration. You know, she was so excited and so so full of aspirations. That is really the best word for it, I think, but she had so many dreams and things that she wanted to do. And then sort of the hard reality of arriving in the U.S., of having no paperwork because she overstayed a visa, of not being able to find a job. And then later on, she brought her son to the U.S., and then he also was undocumented. And sort of just trying to make a life happen under some very difficult circumstances. So she was very sort of driven by this notion of salir adelante, right, mm-hmm. of getting ahead. But it turned out that, you know, when she arrived at the U.S., the main sort of bulk of her labor evolved around just getting by.
Right.
Like when this aspiration sort of hit the reality of sort of entry-level work in the United States that you know, many labor migrants undergo, right? Mm-hmm. And the other testimony I have there in that first chapter is that of Domitila. And Domitila is interesting because she was also living in this sort of larger aspirational economy that dominated the area at the time that I did my research there, which was in the first half of the 2000s, right? And she was embedded in this sort of tightly knit family network of people who were migrating to Maryland and Washington, D.C. That network, or that family network, had started with sort of the typical case of a pioneer female migrant who migrated as a domestic worker in mm-hmm. the late 1970s also, and then for a Peruvian diplomatic family, and then ended up in Washington, D.C., ended up staying, working for several diplomatic families, and then ended up staying and bringing a lot of her relatives. So at the time that I met the pioneering migrant that I call Ellen Hyung in the book, she had almost managed to bring like 40 of her nieces and nephews and brothers and sisters right. to the United States. In this, she was caught up in that migration. Domitila was caught up in that migration stream somewhat involuntarily, because it was her sister who was supposed to migrate in her place.
Right.
The arrangement had already been made for her to migrate, but then the sister, the younger sister, sort of quote-unquote, deserted, right, that family migration project because mm-hmm. she had a boyfriend and she really didn't want to leave for the United States. And then it was considered that the family was sort of losing out on this opportunity for diversifying their income, right? So they
right.
had to send someone, and then that someone became Ines, and she Domitila,
right.
and she ended up migrating sort of a little bit against her will, but to help out the family, leaving a child behind.
Right.
That she then did not see for almost 10 years mm-hmm. at this point, with these incredible sort of social and emotional costs, right,
right,
in order to sort of fit into this family and community-driven migration project.
Yes, you know, those are two great case studies, I think, to open up the book and really highlight two of the, you know, common themes that perhaps, you know, underlie the decision to migrate for, you know, a number of sure. migrants, and not just, of course, Andean Peruvians. But so you mentioned the first is this, Ines represents the aspirational force that drives, you know, some, mm-hmm. you know, some to migrate, this desire to get ahead, as you say, salir adelante. Mm-hmm. And then you have Domitila, who represents the moral objective, right? Or the kind of,
yeah.
The moral responsibility, right? As a pioneer, she was connected to this lineage, if you will, of migration. This is a migration that's a strategy, as you mentioned, that allows the family to diversify its not only its earning potential, you know, of course, but also its own, you know, social advancement, its place within the community. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, this is fascinating within your work. You and a number of migration scholars connect, you know, the opportunity that this. That transnational migration creates for people, not just to get ahead in the way that they are leaving their home country and making something anew of themselves in the receiving country, this being the United States. But what that opens the door for their own social advancement and, you know, back home, you know, not just in the forms of consumption, or even consumerism and, you know, but, in their status within the community itself. And so this creating this, perpetual chain of migration and being part of that had so much, she felt such a sense of responsibility in acknowledging and understanding how much her family had put into this process, all the time, all the money. As you mentioned, Domitila couldn't let this pass. I mean, that sense of moral obligation, she could not let all of that work go to waste or risk her family's, you know, the value that this was to her family, even though it meant leaving her child behind. It was just, it was heart-wrenching, you know, to read that. And you know, just, I think, but a phenomenal case study, both of those, you know, to really highlight those two driving forces, that are just two of many, perhaps, but very common, perhaps, right?
No, that's great. And thank you for mentioning that. Also, because I feel one of the things that I wanted to do was also to get away of, you know, of the, from that notion of the migrant as sort of this individual rational actor, right, who only makes choices based on sort of individual desires, and that, you know, especially with Domitila's case, it is sort of a moral predicament, right? It becomes something that she has to do in order to reproduce not just herself as a sort of a successful migrant subject, but also her family and her sort of close community.
Right. And also, as you point out, that it's so much more than just purely economics, you know, and materiality, which I think is interjected so much, you know, in the discussion of migration and both migrants themselves, why they do what they do. Yes, that's a key component of it. This is about survival. But for, you know, as you mentioned in throughout the book, for these people, it's not their only option. For some of them, you know, they could stay, you know, they could return to Peru and have a, you know, a good life, right? And so it's not merely about survival, but it's about the opportunity and, you know, this, again, this concept of the self, where they want to be, what they would like to become, and how transnational migration, not only again for themselves, the individual, but for their family, for their community, how all that factors into this decision and the sacrifices that go into, you know, migrating transnationally.
Yeah, absolutely.
So wonderful. And that's, I mean, that's just the opening of the book. The second chapter, which I was also, again, we're still in the process of kind of these, right, the fashioning of self as you know, you're leaving or just entering into that transnational migratory circuit. But the second chapter then starts to address, you know, the experience of that migration. The sense of identity as it comes through, you know, the subjectivity of being a migrant, and having to, enter into this process without, you know, without, you know, clear, I'm losing my train of thought here. I apologize, but without losing, or without having access to, you know, direct or, I hate to say the word, you know, legitimate forms of obtaining paperwork to do so, right? So you're, we're really getting at is you start to explain this migrant industry that has developed that helps to support migrants who are looking to migrate transnationally. Many of these have already made the rural to urban jump and experience and now are about to make that next transition. So can you talk a bit more about the migration industry and particularly, again, how the fashioning of self intersects with, for example, the process of obtaining certain types of visas? I mean, this was a fascinating part of this chapter where you start to connect how migrant entrepreneurs and industry professionals help migrants to really fashion an identity that fits the particular use of a visa, whether it's a student visa, you know, an artist visa, whatever it may have been, but it's really this sense of, you know, traveling like a student or traveling like an artist. So can you talk a bit more about how this chapter really teases that out?
Yes, absolutely. I'd be happy to. So the chapter kind of builds on the argument that I lay out in the introduction of the book, which is, you know, that mobility has always shaped Andean livelihoods, but that access to transnational mobility in particular, and all the sort of associated capitals, right, has always been highly uneven, and it has historically also been almost sort of a monopoly of the elite to travel internationally until very recently, right?
Right.
So, and this is like perhaps in the past couple of decades that Andean Peruvians of sort of more modest means and of who are racialized also as indigenous persons within the Peruvian context, they have now increasingly had or have acquired access to transnational mobility, but in these simultaneously very constrained ways, right? And that is what I'm trying to do in the book's second chapter. It's called Paper Fixes, The Making of Mobile Subjects. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to analyze in sort of great detail all the kind of work and labor that goes into producing oneself as a mobile subject, right?
Right,
because
right.
So sort of historically also, even to travel to the United States, and even before, before migration to the United States, but with mobility internally in Latin America, you always had to sort of produce yourself as a member of the elite in order to be entitled to that kind of mobility, right?
Right.
But for the case of, for example, U.S. visas, even though that, you know, the website of the American consulate in Lima says that they give out visas to people from all regional background, which is very interesting to me that they will say that explicitly, noting, you know, these sort of differences between the Peruvian Andes and the Lima on the coast, right? Then, you know, the truth is that for people who come from the Andean regions, they bear the burden of proof, right, of their class status and of their and of the way that they are racialized and institutionalized racism. So in order to produce themselves as someone who would be worthy of a tourist visa and not a labor migrant in disguise, right? They have to sort of fit this profile of the urban middle class person who goes on vacation to the United States and
right.
who is definitely enough anchored in Peruvian society to convince the interviewing officer, right, that they will come back and eventually reincorporate themselves in Peruvian society.
Mm-hmm.
So many people from the Andes, they sort of historically have a very ambiguous relationship with writing and with bureaucracy in general, because it has been to their detriment since the colonial period, right, most of the time.
Right.
So they often ally themselves with these sort of migration professionals, you could all almost call them, right? What I call the migration industry, which are all of these kind of people who trying to make a profit out of helping people with visa paperwork, with they tutor them in how to comport themselves and in sort of regulating their affective demeanor when they go to the visa interview. It's really very interesting. And then also coach potential or wannabe migrants and what are the visa types that they could try to apply for, right? So then it becomes the question of whether they want to construct themselves as sort of the student for an F1 visa who's going to study at a U.S. institution, or
right.
whether they want construct themselves as a successful business person in Peru who's going to some sort of convention in the United States, or even, you know, there have been people who have traveled as, you know, members of folkloric ensembles or as religious personnel, right, invited by a church in the United States, etc. And of course, you know, one can say the reason why people do this and engage in these kind of various forms of unauthorized travel is because it has, to a great extent, become the viable form of travel for people who are not eligible for the official visas because of structural racism and discrimination in a variety of ways, right? They then have to turn to these kind of alternative forms of travel. And, you know, that some scholars who work at sort of the intersection of this, I prefer the term migration industry because I think that it sort of highlights the complex of services mm-hmm. that facilitates migration, right? Instead of talking about it's not really human trafficking because there's no element of deception right. in this, in the traditional way that people know, you know, maybe people are, you know, they're going to work for some uncle in the U.S. and they end up getting paid much less than what they thought. But it's not deception in the sense that scholars of human trafficking would have it, right?
Right, right.
Or that not so much the scholars, but actually the legal definition of human trafficking. So people really put a great deal of work and effort into constructing themselves to fit these categories. And then what they have, if they're granted a visa, you know, then it's like you have to perform mm-hmm. to the standards of the paperwork that you are embodying, right? So
right.
that becomes sort of the second phase of this travel. And then, of course, you know, sort of in the era of biometrics, this whole process has been much more complicated. And there are, of course, also, examples of failed, examples of where people simply fail to live up to that identity which they have constructed, which they have to perform, right, at multiple points during the process through the visa interviews at the arrival at the U.S. port of entry, which is always intimidating, I guess, even for those of us who travel with authorization or with a visa or passports or green cards, right? It is in itself a very intimidating experience. And imagine for someone who's trying to sort of validate that they are indeed representing the documents that they are carrying, right?
Right, right. Well, and that aspect of performance is what was really convincing for me to, and you're labeling this as an industry. Mm-hmm. It really helped me to understand, of course, reading throughout the chapter, you know, how much coaching went involved, how much scrutiny went into from the side of the broker, right, the migration broker in choosing mm-hmm. what was the right type of visa and the right type of identity and performativity that this migrant could thereby inhabit and pass, right, throughout mm-hmm. this process. It was incredibly mm-hmm. complex. So in addition to just the array of services, if I can, right, the professionalism, that goes yeah. into this industry and, you know, obtaining, you know, throughout the, providing the service to these migrants is just incredibly in-depth and complex. Mm-hmm. Also on the aspect of performativity, I think we can understand this, as you've mentioned, even if this doesn't just happen to those that are trying to pass, if you will, the migration process or visas in, you know, without, standard or legitimate type of documents. I was taking an undergraduate seminar quite a while ago, not too long ago, mm-hmm. but, we talked about this in this seminar, which is really about, it was a seminar on immigration. We mentioned how even just I grew up along the U.S.-Mexico border in San Diego. And before 9/11, it was very frequent and very easy to cross that border. You just jump in a car, or you'd walk across it. And in this class, we discussed what happened and how we acted when you were driving across the border back, north from Mexico, right, coming through the border checkpoint. It was a completely different experience than when you crossed. When you crossed, everything's really just easy. You just literally drove. You just literally walked. There was no real check or an inspection. On the way back, however, and this is, again, back in, like, the early to mid-90s, late 90s, however, when you get to that point where the immigration officer asks you either for identification or is checking citizenship, immediately people in the car straighten up. You put your hands at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel, and you start to perform and behave what you consider is appropriately to even pass, even if you have citizenship, right? To make sure you are not, scrutinized or, put into secondary inspection, which actually comically happened to my family once when we were coming back across. Despite the fact that my parents had all the documents and everything, we're all U.S. citizens and everything, my dad just ended up saying something wrong. He actually admitted to having the car painted in Mexico. And so since we had the car painted in Mexico, they then sent us to secondary where they made us all get out of the car. And anyways, long story short,
he was probably trying to disguise something.
Yeah. Right? Well, he was actually just being honest, but he learned, after that inspection, you don't tell these guys squat. Like, you don't tell them if you bought anything down there. You don't tell them if you actually got the car painted, because that just opens the door for a heightened, amount of scrutiny and suspicion, that thereby creates very uncomfortable situations, So, it was just in a very, very small way, reading this, the narrative and the experiences of and how much, performativity goes into embodying the right type of actions, the right type of identity.
Yeah.
I could even see myself like, yes, I've had to do that also, even with papers, right? Even, being a lifelong citizen, there is just that aspect when you're crossing that border, that there's an appropriate way to perform, and behave, and you need to inhabit that and produce that. Yeah. Otherwise, you put yourself in risk or danger, right?
Absolutely. And then that goes to illustrate also how, because of course the only thing that border officials, they have is that they read the documents against what they see. And this is why racial profiling is such an issue, right? And such a real reality for many people, because it depends so much on how you look and how you can, the kind of affective demeanor that you can demonstrate in that moment where you're all stressed out about performing in the right way. That then can come to have sort of very detrimental consequences for your life further on. Right?
Exactly. It's time we transition to the second part of the book, which focuses more on how the migrants stay connected and relevant in the lives of their loved ones back home. This, of course, within the same theme of, the performance and production of self. So can you talk about that? Particularly, you introduced the concept of, remote sensing, and, transnational families. And so can you, you address how do these Peruvian migrants do this? How do they stay connected? How do they stay relevant to children, to family members, et cetera?
Yeah. They try to, and again, I shall say that I try to focus in this chapter and the one that follows also, which focuses more on visual communication, but I focus on all the labor that goes into producing and reproducing social relationships across borders, right? So for many of the migrants that I worked with in the book, they migrated, and particularly, both the men and the women, but in particularly the women who left children behind, that came to be sort of a very defining part of their experience as migrants in the U.S., right? And they did everything they could, especially in their early years or in the first couple of years after migration, to stay in contact, right, with the children that they had left behind and with the relatives who had custody over those children in their absence. So one of the things that I try to focus on is how the sort of lived experience of communicating across borders pans out, right? And I also want to make an intervention into sort of debates that perhaps sometimes have a little bit of optimism around communication technologies, right? That saying, oh, you know, even though that it's hard to be away from your family, the fact that we have Skype and we have all of these other technologies mean that people can stay in contact as ever before, right? And right. What I'm arguing here in the book is that, yes, people can stay in contact in more dense and more frequent ways than ever before, but that is not necessarily a good thing, and it definitely does not ameliorate some of the sort of profound experience of loss that both parents and children on either side of the border, they feel as a consequence of migration, right? So I'm saying, you know, yes, communication technology, it does change the everyday experience of being away from your relatives and from your family members, but it doesn't sort of ameliorate the emotional and social consequences of that separation.
Right.
And then...
Go ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and so can you address how, again, so how, even with these new communicative technologies, whether they be Skype, you talk a lot of the production of videos in three different particular types of, genres or videos that are produced by Andean migrants and sent home, and how they have specific functions. But can you speak to the aspect of, again, performativity and self and identity that goes into those communications, right? How one has to perform appropriately in order to try to, you know, establish or maintain these relationships despite, across transnational space.
Yes, absolutely. And I realized that I didn't, you were asking about the concept of remote sensing, which I use. And of course, it's a concept that comes from geography. And it refers to sort of this acquisition of information about an object or a phenomena on the earth through this technological mediation. And I'm using it to show how migrant parents, for example, they attempt to know something or sense something about an object of desire, in this case a child, right, from afar, through this process of technological mediation. And that is, not only Skyping, but also, phone contact and the circulation of videos, both online and at the time that I started this research, people were still circulating video tapes. Now they're circulating video files, right? But when I started this work, they were still circulating the actual physical tape. And I think one of the interesting things about the circulation of the visual is that sort of the indexical quality of the image, right? The image will always attempt to claim the status of truth, right? So people often think that if they have seen something, then it must be right. So in the context, for example, of collective migrant remittances, when migrants abroad, they send donations back home, it became to help the local football team or to put new benches in the church or to, repair the roof of the municipality in this rural community of origin, whatever it was. In order to sort of make sure that the money was used for or destined for the project that it was actually given for, they would sometimes require that sort of local politicians would send videos of the completed works to the migrant organization in the U.S. and in this way have the visual proof that these collective remittances had actually been used appropriately, right? But then these videos, they also circulated in a more intimate sphere in the form of video letters between relatives And that though, and also, you know, again, it was often actually connected to the use of remittances. So sometimes, you know, relatives back home, they would shoot sort of little bits of video to show that, you know, they were in the process of completing that home extension or home improvement project that they had received money to do by the migrant abroad, or that they had bought the presents for the children that they had received remittances to do, and all those, that sort of things. And then in the book, I also have this case of one migrant who went back to be the sort of sponsor of the patron Saint Fiesta or festival in the right. in the community. He had also circulated these videos in order, of course, to bolster his legitimacy and his social status and his capital within this transnational community of migrants. But then there was also issues with him. His wife did not go, and then, you know, he was dancing with this other paisana, and that came out on the video. So there were also all these sort of aspects of trying to edit out things that you didn't want others to see. So what I'm saying is that, you know, greater connectivity does not necessarily lead to sort of a more fluid and transparent communication, but it forces migrants and their relatives who are left behind in the home country to be more and more aware of how they perform how they construct their identities and the sort of self-making via these various forms of technologies and the circulation of images that they generate.
Yes, you know, and just as you're explaining it to me, you know, again here, it just sounds so exhausting.
I know.
I'm talking about this aspect of performativity where, you know, they're having to perform appropriately in whatever local context it is. So whether they are, you know, here in the receiving region or community, whether it's, so it's, say it's Paterson, New Jersey, and either they're at work or they're within the home that they're staying in, there's multiple levels of how they are expected to perform, and they're trying to meet those expectations to, again, operate fluidly and safely through these spaces. And then that doesn't end even within the most personal and strong connections of loved ones back home. There is still the aspect of performing appropriately and, you know, the whole issue of, you know, surveillance that you bring up within this, you know, these discussions of these videos and how that connects to, you know, how one is expected to perform appropriately. It's, again, it just sounds, it's just exhausting, you know, emotionally. I feel, you know, drained just trying to just, you know, reading through it and listening to it and trying to understand what that is like. In essence, it seems like these migrants always have to be on, right? You know, that spotlight is always on them, regardless of the public or private space they are in and who they're communicating with to, again, produce themselves in ways that are, you know, received the way that they would like them to be.
Absolutely. And that is, of course, I mean, that is the key idea in the book as a whole, because then in the following chapter, in chapter 5, which is about public performances in public spaces in Paterson, New Jersey, which is sort of one of the early areas of Peruvian migration to the northeast. They do this Peruvian parade every year. And that is, of course, sort of in the spirit of ethnic parades in the U.S., but it has that same sense of having to perform according to these various standards and evaluations, right? So even the organizing committee would always call my attention was that there was this high level of anxiety around how to represent what would then be taken by others to mean the Peruvian community
right.
in the U.S., right? So
mm-hmm.
there that's also another situation in which you see this sort of pressure to perform according to these norms, whether these norms are like a particular way of being Peruvian and a sort of a folklorized element of a larger U.S. Latino group, or whether it is to sort of perform yourself as the docile, hardworking, property-owning, successful Latino immigrant, right, which is kind of the other archetype that is at play at these public events, but sort of the essence of having to perform according to those standards in a given setting are the same in that chapter for public events.
Yes, and what I found fascinating in that chapter particularly is you discussed how, the folkloric, like, if labeled folkloric, like performances of, Andean migrants in this parade does two things. It both, claims space and membership for themselves in a positive way as Peruvians. So they are inserting and claiming space, as part of that, those larger tropes. They're inserting, their identities and themselves and saying, this is also Peruvian. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, being a parade that's performed within the context of a, suburb in the United States, that they are also claiming membership in that community as well. So they are legitimizing themselves, in essence, and being truly as a transnational subject, but as part of a transnational community, as a citizen and a representative of what it means to be Peruvian, but then also as someone that has the, claim of being where they are and doing what they're doing, mm-hmm. Working, living in the United States.
Right? Yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it has this kind of dual aspect to it, and of course it's interesting because with the whole folklore performance, it's also kind of it's a way to assert sort of a specificity within a sort of larger understanding of genericness of a Latino identity in the U.S. Right. On one hand, but then it's also like how to perform this Andean folklore while at the same time stripping it off the social condition of the Indian, right? Because that's something that they definitely do not want to be seen as. All means, they have to perform these folkloric dances in a highly stylized way that kind of strips off any connotation that could link them to sort of a backwards or a rural background, as it were.
Yes, and that's, a strong undercurrent throughout the whole book, is that connection between, the production of self and being modern. You addressed early in the book, the transgressiveness of Andean mobility, and that, this historical sense of them, of the Indian being out of place in urban settings. Yeah. And this is something that is, perhaps in the back of the mind of these migrants, right, as they are imagining initially, or not at the back, but at the forefront of their mind, as they are imagining the initial, taking the first steps of, entering this migratory stream, the production of self is how to cast off the rurality, right, to how to cast off the poverty, and to become modern, to become modern is to become worthy in a way, of being a part of this migratory stream.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so let's touch on the sixth chapter too. This is part of the, there's a conclusion also, but the sixth chapter is along the same theme of, migrants claiming citizenship and belonging, both in sending and receiving nations and as part of being transnational subjects. What I found really interesting in chapter six is your discussion of how this process of being, and the experience of being a transnational migrant can actually, politicize one to be more active and engaged in politics back at home. So in, the sending community, whether it's in, the Andean region or an urban setting in Lima. But can you discuss that? You bring about the concept of, phantom citizenship. So can you explain that and how citizens throughout this process and experience of migration actually become more activists, more involved, more empowered to make a difference back at home?
Yes, absolutely. So since I would say around the 2000s, the Peruvian government, they have begun in different ways to reach out, quote-unquote, to Peruvian communities abroad. And partly, I mean, that's due to a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is that since there is dual citizenship or dual nationality law in place in Peru since the mid-1990s, Peruvians are still not only able to vote in Peruvian national elections, but they are also obligated to do so.
Mm.
So for the Peruvian government, the foreign vote is actually pretty significant in national elections. So they have sort of a very clear incentive to reach out to Peruvians abroad as sort of an immigrant population who are still connected to their country of origin. So that is one reason why the government has sort of continuously since the 2000s reached out to Peruvians abroad. The other reason is, of course, also the importance of remittances and sort of trying to figure out ways of capitalizing on migrant remittances because of its prominent role in the national economy. And then also just simply the sheer number of migrants. Peruvians have been one of the sort of growing, the fastest growing Latino groups in the U.S., and Peruvians are also migrating to other places, but currently about 10% of the Peruvian population live abroad, which is quite significant.
Mm-hmm.
So it is of a concern to the Peruvian state. However, when the state talks about incorporating the Peruvians abroad in the sort of national, this national imaginary that they call el quinto suyo, and that comes from the term Tihuantin suyo, which was the Inca term for the four regions of the Inca Empire. So el quinto suyo is like the fifth region of migrants abroad,
mm-hmm.
but tying it to sort of this notion of the Inca Empire, right?
Right.
Extending beyond Peru's borders. So when they interpolate Peruvians abroad as members of the Quinto Suyo, they're not necessarily thinking of the migrants that are protagonists in this book, right, who are sort of the disenfranchised labor migrants of Andean origin. But then these migrants who are the protagonists of this book, they try to find ways to insert themselves in these ongoing debates of citizenship in Peru. And so in this chapter, I start out the chapter with giving this vignette about lynching in the public square of one of the communities that I work in. And, you know, to make a long story short, some of the local authorities were taken to court because two of these cattle thieves died in the process. And then they ended up mobilizing help to pay for the expenses for the court process from migrant relatives abroad. And so for the migrants abroad, the sort of act of the helping out and being able to help out economically these local authorities of the community, right, against the central state. That was a major it gave them a major sense of empowerment, right, to be able to challenge the state at this level, because they were saying, well, we have been left abandoned here in Andean communities for decades, if not centuries. Then, you know, we have all these issues and the police does not show up until they come and they want to put us into prison for taking justice in our own hands, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And then they were able to actually pay for lawyers to defend their local authorities against the state, right? And that was a very powerful experience for people who have been marginalized as political subjects within their own country, right? So what I'm trying to say is that these sort of transnational flows of capital in various forms, right, also influence and shape the way that people can position themselves ultimately as national subjects in the context of origin.
Right. And those are fascinating examples. And, particularly the one that you mentioned there about the lynching that occurred and then, how that evolved and, the group of migrants that were, responsible for, paying for a bulk of the legal fees, for, the defense, back home and whatnot. So that was just, again, just another, the book is filled with a bunch of fascinating, I think, examples and case studies and, both that are rooted, on, specific experiences of with people, and this process of migration and their experience between it. So I thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on, New Books in Latino Studies and discuss mobile selves. As we wrap up the interview, our closing question is, giving you an opportunity to talk about what it is you're working on now. I know you have other projects that I read that you're involved in. You're a filmmaker also. I know you also run, I think, the Latino Studies Institute at Rutgers. Is that correct?
It's a Center for Latin American Studies, but I am a faculty in the Department of Latino and Caribbean Studies.
Okay, gotcha. So can you tell us a little bit more about what it is you're working on now as we wrap things up today?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm currently working on two new multi-year research projects. And the first one, I think, is kind of probably emblematic of where many migration scholars end up these days, which is that we end up working on immigrant detention and deportation simply as a result of how the current political climate has unfolded in the United States. So I'm working now on a new book, tentatively titled Buddies in Confinement, Migration Immobility and the U.S. Deportation Industry. And in that book, I'm trying to look at sort of the underside of migration, right, which is failed migrations, because in this book that we've just talked about, I spend a lot of time talking about how people perform in order to produce their own mobility, right?
Right.
And the detention and deportation is kind of almost the immediate consequence of a failure of producing yourself as a mobile subject, right? So I'm doing research in detention centers in New Jersey and also with people, former migrants who have been deported back to Peru and Ecuador, and I'm currently also looking to expand to Colombia, where I will be doing interviews. I've already started the project and the research is ongoing, but I'm doing interviews with people who have spent time in detention in the U.S. and who have been deported, and then I'm looking at how are they faring when they come back, what are some of the challenges that they encounter, et cetera, et cetera. So that is one project. And then I'm also working on a second research project, which kind of sounds very different, but I like to think of it as interconnected also. And that is a project that kind of attempts to study power and inequality, but from above, in quotation. And I'm looking there to examine the intersection of race with the distribution of various other forms of capital in the changing character of Peruvian inequality. So that project focuses on sort of elite Peruvians of Andean origins. The project is tentatively titled Todos Somos Cholos, Old and New Elites in Neoliberal Peru. And I'm looking at, in that project, I'm looking at sort of the rise of the much touted figure of the entrepreneurial cholo, right? The person who did not migrate or is a did. They did it not permanently, but in order to acquire wealth in Peru and accommodate themselves in Peruvian society. But then I'm interested in how these Peruvians, sort of a considerable economic wealth, still have not been exempt from racism and adverse forms of discrimination because they trace their origin to the Peruvian Andes, right? I'm going to look at how affluency is also structured along the lines of race and other forms of affective and cultural capital. So that's my second research project. And then I'm working to finish a film that I've been working with for a very long time on the Peruvian poet Domingo de Ramos, who's a very interesting figure. He's an amazing poet, and I've been following his work and his life for over a decade, and I've known him for over two decades. And he's also the sort of example of an incredibly talented artist, but because of his background, tracing his route to the Peruvian Andes, he was never able to break into the sort of high-class culture in Lima. However, his work has been revindicated abroad, in multiplicity of places in Europe, in other places in Latin America, but not in Peru because of sort of the entrenched racism, right, of Peruvian society. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that keep me busy.
Well, and it's fascinating to hear of, you know, the connections, the intersections of, you know, race and class and migration, or, you know, just underlie your work. And it's something I very much appreciated in this book, and those three projects all sound fascinating. So I'll look forward to looking and seeing when they come out.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you again for your time. I just had a great time talking about your book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I did too, absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with Ula Berg, author of Mobile Selves, Race, Migration, and Belonging in Peru and the U.S., published by New York University Press in 2015. We encourage you to grab a copy of Dr. Berg's book, and you may do so by following the link to Amazon on the page of this podcast. Also, you may subscribe to our podcast, New Books in Latino Studies, through iTunes or Stitcher, or feel free to contact us by either sending us an email to newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com or connecting with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you.